something.
Must have dropped, this.
To make it be decorative.
Yeah, must not have always had air.
Thank you, Tamara. Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. This is the 2016 CDBG application review group and work group, and we're here today to talk to some of you folks if we have questions. It's going to work a little bit differently than in past years because we had a little short presentation time period and we had an opportunity for questions after that. This year, we've gone through the applications. We've asked some pre-questions in advance if we needed any from Janice to interface with the groups, and then we're just going to ask questions here today. So I guess we'll go ahead and get started. First up is food for thought, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you want to do a roll call? Should we do a roll call tomorrow? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, on Food for Thought, welcome, hello.
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 Hi. Do you guys want to just print your name on the form and which organization? That'd be great. And then you guys can go ahead and say hello and just say who you are.
I'm Marlene Maffei, Executive Director of Food for Thought.
George Albritton, Bookkeeper for Food for Thought.
Hi. I know all of us have had a chance to review the application. Does anyone have questions they'd like to start with? Okay, go ahead.
And I think what you're doing is wonderful.
Thank you.
But I have to question why, with all the welfare programs and food stamp programs, there's still a need for this type of a program.
The biggest reason behind the need is even though these families are receiving additional assistance, these children rely on breakfast and lunch from the school programs throughout the school year. So come summertime, they typically would go without because the families aren't accustomed to providing the three meals a day for them. The majority of the children we serve are still living hotel, motel population, and so they're coming to the feeding sites. What we see is it's their first meal of the day and probably their only meal until dinner time. So we're trying to kind of fill the gap when school is out, providing a meal throughout the summertime.
Thank you.
Are there other questions from the group today? Go ahead.
Yeah. Do you have a way to measure how many families return for this program year to year versus how many move on and off the program?
For me personally, this is going to be my third summer doing the program. Last year was the first time that I really got to spend a lot of time at the feeding sites and seeing the children. We do have a lot of families last summer that came quite often. There were some, you know, that came hit and miss. So this summer will be the first time that I personally get a gauge. Is it the same faces as last year? I know that these kids move a lot. They're not very steady with their home life. And we even saw that last summer. You know, we had kids coming consistently and then they just were gone. And the other neighborhood kids would say, oh, they moved, they're not here anymore. So we don't take names. It's just kind of a no questions asked. That's a USDA policy. It's just open to kids ages 2 to 18. They come, they have lunch. So this year, and that's one of the things I'm curious to see, how many returning faces there will be. So we just gauge the number that we serve daily and then throughout the entire summer.
What happens to the leftover food? Does it get transferred to another site?
What we did last year, so we served from 11 to 12:30. A lot of the kids will stay until 12:30, and if we have leftover lunches, we can serve them a second lunch. And then if we do have leftover meals that can be reheated or reused the next day, we donate them to the Bridge Church for their, they have an evening dinner outreach that they do. Monday through Friday, they serve dinner to the public. So anything that they can use, we give it to them, and then they serve it out of their little food cart for dinner.
I have a question. With this year's applications, we have more than double the requests than we have available funding. What would you see as the biggest impact to your program if there was only some of the funding available you requested?
I mean, the biggest impact, I think that we will do everything in our effort to make it work. The biggest impact would probably be the quality of the food that we serve. Last year, we were fortunate to utilize some donated food items from the food bank and increase the quality. So we've kind of set the standard for ourselves and the expectation. I mean, the kids loved the meals that we served them. And we want to continue with that expectation. If budget really were to become a big issue and the food items available through the donations were to drastically change, it just might be reduce the quality of food that we serve. We probably wouldn't serve as much protein. We gave them a lot of meat last summer, which was a first, just because our budget allowed for it. So.
You know, I think that's great, and I think I guess just the question that brings is, it looked like your projected expenses for 2016 was mostly centered around salaries, so would that not be adjusted? In other words, you keep the same amount of kitchen workers and whatnot if it's best possible to try and serve the group rather than...
We would, and the salary kind of... We budget for the max hours. I mean, if it came to be that there were 130 kids showing up for lunch every day, that kitchen staff would utilize a full 4 hours to be in there and preparing. You know, if they're only preparing 80 meals a day, then they're getting out of there early. So they're not guaranteed that time. We just have to budget for the max allowed. So it's more that they come in, do their job, and go. But we want them to show up every day. We think, you know, a great part of the program is that we are hiring high schoolers and giving them a job opportunity, and then they're participating in this great community give back. So they're not going to show up every day if we're paying them $7 an hour or asking them to volunteer. So one of the perks for them is, you know, that we pay them, and they do. They show up every day. They do a really good job. They care about the work that they're doing. So that's not an area that we could cut. We have to have somebody get the meals out to the locations every day. So those things we just, you know, we would just have to rearrange, I think, in our food purchases would be our biggest thing.
Since we're talking about the P&L, can you explain the rent at $46,000 a year?
Was that for?
For your, on your profit and loss statement?
Oh, that's for our office. We have donated rent, and that's the fair market value of the rental we receive from our landlord. It's not a cash expenditure, and we allocate none of that cost to this budget request. The only costs that we've requested relate to direct costs related to the program. Direct labor, direct food, any other supplies that are directly used. We allocate no overhead to this program.
So what does each meal break down to and cost?
Last year, we served 4,523 meals, an average of $4.28. $2.74 of it was payroll, $1.31 was actual food cost, 17 cents were supplies, and 6 cents was the vehicle cost for delivering the meals to the sites.
Are there any other questions out there? I know we're getting kind of short on time. Bobby,
do you have any questions? No, I just have positive comments about the organization. And what I see is I think they have strong leverage and community support. And it's a good program. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you guys so much.
Next up, Belize Fire Park. How are you guys doing?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. You know how this works. Tamara has asked us to get you guys to sign in. I don't think you have a chance to sign in yet. Just print, she said, and then the organization. So, thanks. Right, so this is for the ambulance project, for request for an ambulance.
Yes.
This is actually out of the public improvement funding, which is a different bucket of money than the first project was. So you remember that when I'm asking the questions here.
How much is in that bucket?
I can tell you. Yeah, it's exceeded by the request by about 4x on this one instead of just double.
Sorry.
Yeah. But no, $227,000.
Okay. See, we'll leave you some left over. Okay.
Of course. Right. Do we have any questions out there for this project?
Well, I'll start it off again. I have a major question. In reviewing your package, I see absolutely nothing as far as your budget, projection on operating costs. There's just nothing there. Why? I mean, in looking at this, I would have hoped to have been able to look at the fire department's budget to see where the money is being utilized now. And okay. Spent and the financial need for this kind of a grant.
Okay, well, currently, I mean, if you want to look at our enterprise fund and our budgeting for the ambulance division, it's separate from the fire department, all right? So
okay.
So our paramedic division is not tax subsidized, okay? So we're not a fee for, we're a fee for service. So we have 17 employees in our enterprise fund, okay? Then we use fee for service for that. So our overall budget for that, depending on how you look at it, I mean, we budget about $7 million a year, but in reality, we only collect about $3.2 million to be able to do that, which basically covers the cost of the fire department to run that operation, including supplies, personnel, all that stuff along that goes with it. And then in addition to that, the only really general fund monies that we get out of the fire, general fund monies to help subsidize that is in the tune of about $500,000 is where the general fund subsidizes the enterprise fund and the overall general fund of the fire department, if that kind of makes sense. So we are, the reason why we didn't put the specific budgetary factors of maintenance and everything else, that would just be incorporated into our current system of how we currently take care of our fleet and fleet management through the city. So we have the fire department as far as all vehicles that we have, so fire trucks, ambulances, command vehicles, all that stuff, all just taken care of by fleet services. So any of the upkeep, management, and everything else all runs through fleet. So it's really not a fire department budget item that would go to the fleet side, if that makes sense.
But so, you do have a budget for the ambulance department.
Correct. The enterprise fund does have, we do have one, yes.
Okay. And is that available?
Yeah, we can give it to you. But it doesn't include anything for, currently the city does not have, or the fire department does not have a replacement program in their system. They don't have the funds to be able to do it. That's why we're here asking for an ambulance. There isn't any funding in there for replacement of vehicles as an ongoing revenue source. You think there is, but we don't have one. So you'd be more than glad to see the give you the budget, but it's going to show you the operational needs. It's going to show you the operations portion of it, what we spend in supply, what we spend in material, what we subsidize, what our collection rates are, what our automatic write-offs are that we have because we accept Medicare. So like I said, we might bill out $7 million, but we have to write off $3.5 million right out of the gate just because of the way the system works. So I guess is what specifically are you asking for if I can get it to you? Because if I just give you a copy of our enterprise fund budget, you're looking at a lot of stuff that doesn't really apply to you because you're asking for the funding for how we're going to ongoing revenue to take care of the ambulance, the way I understand it, correct?
Partially, yeah.
Okay. So I'll be glad to give it to you, but we're going to tell you what it doesn't have. There's no replacement for equipment in there, and there isn't any long-term planning to replace equipment. That's why we're trying to go out and find these alternatives.
That's a city function.
That's a city function. That's a board decision to allow, under their capital improvement projects, to put funding and money into those allocations, and currently we don't have any. That's why we're here.
Okay. I would like a copy of that.
Sure, I'd be glad to send it to you. You want the whole fire department budget or just the enterprise fund? Because the fire department, you got to remember the fire department, we were funded by two separate sources, general fund, and the ambulance division is an enterprise fund, which theoretically is supposed to operate and be able to make money on its own, even though that program model doesn't work, but we have it set up that way because we are a fee-for-service program. That's why we bill you, and we'll take you to collections if you don't pay your ambulance bill. All of those things are in line. So if I give you the overall budget, I can do that, or just the enterprise fund budget.
Just the enterprise funds would be enough, since so you're only looking to replace the ambulance.
Right.
That's
okay. Otherwise, I'd be asking for $600,000 to replace a fire truck. But that's I know, right? Okay.
Yeah, I have a couple questions.
Sure.
One, in your application, you say Station 52 has 4,499 total emergency calls, of which 35%, which is an approximation, are non-emergent calls. In your math, is a non-emergent call automatically assumed to be low and moderate income?
Well, not automatically, but Station 52's district covers that whole area population. So if we look at the majority of calls in that district, that's under our lower middle income project. So if we look at the percentage of calls that we have there, that allocates of the group of your basic population, we know that those types of those calls are going to be within that range of the lower middle income, because that's pretty much all we cover in that zone, if I explain that right.
So non-emergent does not mean LMI, low moderate income.
Well, a non-emergent call, specifically, it doesn't really matter where in the city that call is, but if you're looking at what that particular district covers, most of that district is covered into the low and moderate income area.
But a non-emergent call would be, I mean, a typical call, a slip and fall that doesn't require transportation to the hospital.
It really depends on how we get the calls dispatched. Let's say, for instance, we get a 911 call that says, my grandmother's having chest pain, right? So we send an engine and ambulance to that call. When we get there, come to find out that she's not having chest pain. She's been short of breath for two weeks and hasn't had pneumonia, but didn't have the available resources to pick up her medications, weren't able to get to the doctor or whatever those issues are. So we end up, you know, transporting those patients to the hospital because right now we don't have any alternative means of doing that. So if you look at those types of that particular call volume, and we break that down into percentages of how many times somebody calls, and we actually have to provide a life-saving 911 patient-critical decision versus, look, this is more of a patient need option, but their only choice was to call us because they really didn't understand how the system works. And that's how we end up with those stats, if that makes that.
Okay. So the proposal for this ambulance is community paramedicine.
It's twofold,
which
right?
Which offers an opportunity to provide a service without the transportation.
Correct. So what we're looking at, we're doing two things. One is our normal 911 response that we currently have in the system. If you call and are having an issue, the fire department shows up, and based on the level of call through dispatch. So again, we'll take somebody who calls for chest pain. You usually get in a fire truck and an ambulance, right? So no matter what, if you're having chest pain, we're going to transport you to the hospital and take care of you, okay? And that's our normal primary use, and that's where a new ambulance is needed, because our rigs right now are running 150,000-plus miles on them. So the other thing we're going to institute is if we have another vehicle, because that's we have to have that, is we're instituting the new paramedicine program, if you will, right, community paramedicine. And what that does is that allows us to, you call 911, right, and our guys show up, and the scenario I said before is that you're not really having chest pains, it's that you didn't take your medications, okay? So do we have to transport you to the emergency room right now? Right now we do, it's the only model we have, but we're trying to present the new system where we can actually leave you at the house, make sure you're contacted to the appropriate medical source, so whether it's urgent care, whether we fill your prescription at Walmart, or whether we make a doctor's appointment for you. We know we don't have to transport you, but we don't have an option right now. So this would also allow us to take our current existing vehicle to retrofit it into what we are going to make a command through the community paramedicine vehicle, which will include some lab work. We're going to have better technology. We're putting in be able to use your phones for FaceTime, but we use an iPad so we can actually talk to the docs. And if you want, we can take a FaceTime of you and show the doctor what the issue is and say, hey, look, is it okay if we don't transport this patient to the hospital? We'll treat them here and get their lab work done for them, and we can either call in a prescript or we can take them to the hospital tomorrow or to a doctor's appointment. That's how that process is going to work, and the vehicles allow us, it's twofold. A new ambulance will replace the current 911 system that we have, which helps us take care of the aging fleet that we have, which takes care of most of the population in Station 52's district. And then that current ambulance that we have, what we're going to do is replace the chassis on that thing. So we go out and buy a new chassis and take the current ambulance box that we have on it, and we put it on that new chassis. That gives us that new vehicle. So it's kind of a twofold process, but we don't have any spares to be able to do that, and that's where the issue is. If we get a new one, we'll fix the other one, and we'll have two in the system to create that.
Do you know the cost of what a chassis costs?
Of the new chassis?
Yeah.
Sure, the new chassis runs about $48,000. They're Ford F-250s or F-450s, two-wheel drive chassis. And then the conversion runs about another $85,000. So we're looking at about, you know, $135,000 to convert to a new chassis. But you have to remember, we have to take one out of our existing fleet to put it in there. So we need a new one to be able to take the old one, and then we'll have two versus just having one, if that makes sense.
We're a couple minutes over here. Is there any last minute questions?
I have a quick one.
Sure.
I know, Chief, in the past there was a problem with collection of people that were not in qualified programs for write-off. You mentioned about 3.5 out of 7 million is written off to qualified programs. Of the other, what's your collection rate now on those past debts?
Well, to give you a specific number on collection rate, I'd say we're probably at roughly 60%, you know, of the folks that are non-Medicare, non-Medicaid patients. But what we are working on is, we just changed the program through Medicaid, so we've been working statewide to change our Medicaid reimbursement rates to where they're actually going after actual cost reimbursement, and we get 60% of the actual cost reimbursement. And right now we're in the approval stage through Medicare to help to do that, and that's also going to help us increase our rate to for collections, which will really help. But that goes through the SPA system, and that's through the state plan amendment, which we've already done, through CMS, Centers for Medicare Services, and then it gets approved for statewide, and everybody will work on that. But our collection rate, our actual bad debt has actually gone off. About a year ago, we were writing off about $650,000 a quarter. And this last year, we only wrote off $650,000 for the year. So we're working on, we've changed our format on how we do some of the reporting. We've also done implementation on different ways to increase revenue as far as all the different paperwork and some technologies to help billing faster. And we're getting into those folks, and we're looking at a change in Medicaid to help us increase our collection rates.
So I hate to cut this short. Is there a possibility we can get some questions to them and have them get back to us while we're talking to some of the others or whatnot?
I think so,
and
if you want the enterprise budget, maybe we can get that before.
You email it to me.
Yeah.
Okay. I have it here, and I'll print something.
Sure.
Okay.
It's a complicated system, so.
Yeah, Robert had a question, and also Carol had a question, but we've got other groups here.
Yep.
We got time.
So,
go ahead, Robert.
Okay. I think it is at least.
It's easier for me to talk about than I can talk.
Do you know how ambulances have been funded in the past?
Yes. They were funded through the enterprise fund. The last ones we bought were about 5 or 6 years ago, and based on excess reserves, and also some the general fund kicked into some of that also to help buy those. But because of our increase in call volume and increase in cost, we don't have any extra revenue in our enterprise fund.
The other question quickly is, how long do you expect the ambulance to last? How many miles, how many years?
Usually between 3 to 5 years is the norm, right? If you look at our surrounding areas, most of the folks are turning ambulances over about 70,000 miles just because they're a hard run, that 70,000 miles. We're actually, our group works about 125,000 to 150. We'd like to replace them, but we are more than that now, and we know that because you got to figure we're running 30,000 miles a year, and those go from dead stop to right out of the gate every day. So that's some of the mileage issues that we have. So normally, if we could turn them every 3 years, that would be awesome. That would be optimal if we could put that in the system, but we don't. So we have to come in whenever we can find the funds to be able to purchase one. We can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Next up, we have Clear Creek Bowman and Carson City Parks and Rec for the Centennial Park Archery Range project. Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Doing well. All right. I'll start this off with a question here. Going through. Would you guys like to introduce yourselves? I apologize.
Sure. I'm Tom Howell, and this is Jim Davis. We're both on the board of the Clear Creek Bowman. Our club's been in Carson for 40 years, and we've been at our current location, part of the Centennial Park Sports Complex, for the past 13.
It's a great organization. So the question I was wondering about was, there was a section of the budget allocated to advertising, and with respect to this project, how would that advertising be used?
I would have to refer that to Vern Kahn. He's the project manager for the Parks and Rec, but I'm assuming that this project would go out for bid, and I believe that's what the $700 is for.
It's not a billboard or something.
No, it's different. No, we have to, there's the city processes that are used. If we go through a formal bid process, we have to advertise in the newspaper and do those kind of things.
And that costs money. Okay.
Costs money.
Perfect.
And then the field doesn't give it to us for free.
Sadly not.
No.
Shucks. Okay. And the other question I was wondering about was with the cost that you have, and again, on this project, this is actually a public improvement project, so we actually have roughly 3 or 4 times the request that we have funds. How will help from Carson City Public Works keep the cost low on this project for you guys?
I can answer that as well. Carson City Public Works charges just their hourly rate plus what benefits are. There's no profit on top. Okay. So if you were to go to the private sector, like to a professional engineering firm, they would not only have their hourly rate plus benefits, but there would be an overhead and profit on top, and that's not what public works charges. You basically get about, this is roughly, but about anywhere from 50% to 60% of what you would normally get charged in the private sector, public works charges us.
Okay, great. How about other questions out here?
Can you tell us more about the number of people you expect to serve? And how you got to your estimate of the number of handicapped or wheelchair people that you expect to participate at this site?
Well, as I explained in the application, it's sort of a chicken and an egg situation. Until we get some sort of a handicapped capable facility, it's hard to try to extrapolate. The other compounding factor is we have club events at the range, usually once a week from March through October, and including we usually have 4 or 5 specific events in addition to that. Other than that, the range is open to the public 7/24. What reason this came about primarily is our work with the Wounded Warriors. We've been putting on an event in conjunction with a group out of Reno for about the past 5 years. And there's been such a response to the archery portion of the Wounded Warrior Day. They hold that down at the water ski park south of Carson. And we usually transport five or six appropriate bales and all of our equipment down and set it up for the handicapped warriors to use. And that response has been really, really phenomenal.
Can you give us an estimate of the numbers?
During that particular portion, I'm guessing we have at least, they usually have probably 50 to 60 participants, and most all of them are very interested in getting into the sport. And we it encompasses all types of disabilities, as you can imagine. One item I put in this application, if this project is approved, it will be the only non-commercial handicapped archery facility in Northern Nevada. To my knowledge, there is one other commercial facility in Reno, but the cost is about $20 an hour to use the facility. So obviously our focus is to try to develop a venue where the handicapped can in fact pursue archery as a hobby without, you know, additional expenses.
I understand, I will disclose, I'm very close to this whole thing, so.
I know you from somewhere.
but I do have a question in the grant. As I asked the fire department for, since this is city property, it is a park, a city park, there's nothing in the grant package that indicates why the city has not come in and put this, made this an ADA approved park.
No,
do you have the?
I'd like to basically tell you,
sure.
We have funding for it.
Okay.
That's a decision. It's just one of those facilities that, just like many around town, we just don't have the funds citywide to provide ADA facilities, which is unfortunate, but true.
Well, I know. Because I go to the other end. Could we get a copy of the budget for future improvements?
There's
or is there just isn't any?
It just isn't there. I mean,
okay.
What I would give you is a zero, because right now there's no money, whether in residential construction, definitely not from the general fund. There's no money coming to us from the general fund for these kind of improvements. Residential construction tax doesn't apply in this situation because it's not a neighborhood park. And question 18 monies are all used up right now currently with the MAC. So this is really the only opportunity we have to address this need through community development block grant. And we have no match funds. And that's the other beauty of this grant, as I understand it. It doesn't require any grant funding match for ADA improvement. So the coverage there is basically the bottom line. And that's why these folks have stepped up and have made this effort to put these facilities. Even though the city is required to have, or we want to have all of our park facilities to be ADA accessible. And in this particular case, it's not, and we want to get there. And these folks are willing to help us do that.
So Vern, to follow up on that, so going forward, you do have a master plan, a strategic plan for all your facilities and what it would probably cost, or maybe not cost, but you have a plan of what the needs are for ADA compliance in all your other facilities. It's probably a huge list.
I can honestly say, no, we do not.
You don't?
No, we don't. We just know that anytime we have the opportunity to improve a facility, we will make it ADA compliant.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's that partial funding. Would it be suitable for this project? Have you sought other funding sources or sponsorships or donations of materials?
We have heard rumors. One of our members works pretty closely with Home Depot. They will, in fact, help out, but it's a pretty involved process, as you can imagine, and they're not really amenable to doing projects that are, in fact, in a city venue. In other words, if it was a privately private operation somewhere, they would probably get involved. But it's sort of dicey right now as to whether they would even get involved in this particular project as it sits.
Questions? Thank you very much, guys.
Okay.
Thank you. Next on the list is the Carson City Harvest Hub. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
We're good. How about you? Good.
If you ladies would just like to introduce yourselves first, and then we can see what questions come up.
I'm Amanda Long. I'm the president of the Carson City Harvest Hub.
I'm Joyce Buckingham. In this capacity, I'm on the board of directors for the Harvest Hub project.
Okay. Great. So we will have some questions for you guys. I know I have some, but I want to ask the rest of the group first if they have any.
I'm sure it's been pointed out that in your budget there was an error on.
Yes.
I did it. It was me. I got one too many zeros. It's like, oh, it's already in.
We've had like several people look at it, so. It's
that's referring to the lease amount, right?
Correct.
Yes.
$54,500.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that when I saw it. I thought, oh, that's what I get doing it the night before. That's on me.
Also, on the requested amount, you are requesting $277,000, not $227,000.
227.
Okay,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
Sorry about that.
And there's no politically correct way to ask this question. Downtown is undergoing a facelift, and with all the improvements that are coming into town, why set this project right in the middle of that, with homeless indigents coming in and out of the beautification of Carson City? How do you justify the reaction of that?
Would you like me to?
Yes, go ahead.
Basically, the broad targeted population that we specified means that we're going to serve everyone, okay?
Everybody.
Hey, you know, and here's the deal, is that we are in belief that any individual, and a lot of whom we plan to serve are low to moderate income, they deserve the right to quality year-round farm-to-table produce and food products. So whereas we're looking at serving the amount of people we are, we think that that is very modest. What we really feel our large targeted population is going to be more people on the west side, individuals.
But the question is, how do you interface that with the beautification of Carson City's downtown project and bringing all of this into right in the middle of downtown instead of on 50th or another street that is not undergoing this street beautification project?
It's our targeted population to be able to have year-round, the farmers market is on that side of town, for goodness sakes. What we're doing is we're proposing that we're able to serve low to moderate income through this particular project, because we are going to do outreach and make sure that they know that those foods are there. As far as the beauty of bringing in the whole community, we feel that the lion's share of who we're going to serve, okay, when we look at the extended numbers and so forth, is going to be more people on the west side. We feel with the outputs and outcomes that we've got here that those are modest numbers. But it is a new project, so I don't know how to address those type of people coming downtown, because that's not the way we're looking at this project. This is a project for all people. This is a project that will not discriminate, because we're looking not to have organic foods at a high price that other individuals can afford. In In fact, what we're trying to do is to reduce the price based on their income so that everybody has the right to whole, nutritious, fresh produce and foods from the local farms. Is that it?
I have to go back to your budget for a couple minutes. The request amount was $200,000 for rent plus $100,000 for the renovation for a total of $300,000.
Right, and so the amount for the lease and the rent is adjusted, but...
So let me finish the question. Okay. So it indicates that you've got $340,000 in other funding. If you subtract, if you correct the rent to $54,000, take $54,000 plus $100,000, that's $154,000, and you've got twice that in other funding.
Yeah, that should be crossed out. I think when we made the error over here on 540, we were balancing it out on this page.
We were. And so that should be 34,000.
Yeah.
It's 34,000.
Instead of 340,000. It's just one too many zeros.
And where is that coming from?
Well, first of all, we have Ron Wood Family Resource Center, who I represent, is in fact going to use this as an enclave, a work experience program for foster youth. And that is youth basically 16 to 21. What I have in my John B. Chafee grant is money that will assist young people in developing good habits, good skills, and getting to work on time. Good attendance obviously is important, dependability. Also learning to do real work out there. So blending that in with what the Food Hub, the Harvest Hub rather, is looking to do is a wonderful opportunity for customer service, for stocking shelves, for cleaning.
I see 24,000 as youth and staff employment.
Yeah, the whole
perhaps
column.
Where's the 34,000 for the rent?
Oh, up here in the top. I think she said that she meant the whole column should be 34. On this one. It's up in here.
Right, right.
And then that together would be.
Right. It's obvious we made a mistake on the budget page, okay? Because pretty much not making any excuses, we were trying to get this done at the last moment. And obviously, I added some numbers in there that didn't jive, so I apologize for that. I can tell you that we do have a commitment from Ron Wood. We also have a commitment from an investor that has stated that she would give $10,000 to $20,000 for she wanted to see the business plan. She hasn't decided, so that was kind of factored in there. So that is still to be determined where that restricted funding would go.
And one last question. You got $100,000 for building improvements, and it's for a building that you won't own, and if you leave it, the owner of the building gets a $100,000 upgrade. Is that correct?
Well, so the agreement with that is that it's Old Horseshoe Club, and so they're having their tenants build within, like, so they're separating the areas, the three retail areas, and so each tenant has to do their own improvements on it. And so we have a kitchen, we have improvements that we have to make to the existing walk-in fridge and, you know, all the carpet, and like basically it was a casino, so we have to change it into a viable place for the Harvest Hub.
So one thing that isn't factored in here is since we've done this, there's been a few things that have changed, and one of which will reduce that $100,000. We have a contractor who's donated his time. So we don't have a figure on that yet, what that in-kind is going to be, but that would reduce that tremendously.
Okay.
One other question here. What would you say to the interaction with Ron Wood and the Harvest Hub and possibly the fact that we have other food banks in town as far as the duplication services? Because that's one thing that we have to be careful of here. On some of these, we have requests for, like I said, 3 to 4 times the funding. How will that be managed?
Well, as Amanda stated, Amanda, speak up anytime, girl, but as Amanda stated in the grant application, it is not a duplication of services because Ron Wood and the other food banks don't get the fresh farm-to-table produce. I mean, we're talking about a very different market than what we get. Most of what we get is stale bread, canned foods, frozen meats from the supermarket that get frozen right before they get to date, so that we can still receive them and get them out to families that are nutritious. But there is no bleed over. And also, you're looking at the bistro, the coffee shop, the juice bar, those types of things too, which again are going to bring in revenue.
And so we're working with farmers that are out, you know, so Fallon has a food hub. And they're creating, they're aggregating the food, which means that they're working with all the farmers out there to collect different foods. And so we would be working with them to provide that here in Carson. And so we wouldn't have to necessarily go out, you know, and do that part of it. But we would have all the access to the fresh food and stuff that they aggregate and work with them. So it helps bring in a completely different type of food than what is currently offered.
As far as your renovations, you mentioned having to put in a refrigerator. Have you guys looked at looking into locations that are second generation locations, you know, that already have that in place?
Yeah, and there's not a lot here in Carson. So we've been looking for a location for 3 to 4 years now, and this is the first one that we've been able to make work for this project and to get something that's, you know, within a reasonable price and with all that already there, without us having to build that and put that money in to create a whole commercial kitchen and the facility that we need.
Nothing I saw in your package really projected what you are planning to charge, what your expenses are going to be, your expected profit loss. Are those figures available?
I might have something in our business plan. I know that we just kind of did a redo of our budget, and so I do have something that we could probably provide to you guys that has an idea of what our membership costs would be, what our, what else was that last night that
we were talking about, like $200 for a lifetime membership and $20 a year.
So similar to like a co-op, what a co-op would do, you would charge a lot for lifetime memberships, or you would have annual memberships.
None of that's in this package.
Yeah, and so that's kind of come to light just like since we've done this. We've consulted with somebody who helped us a little bit more with our business plan and the numbers and the figures and really hashing all of that out. And so some of that's come to light between the time of this and now. And so what I could provide you would probably have some of that information.
Understanding that yours is an improvement grant and Ron Woods is a service grant. So I understand the two different grants, but it just seems strange to me that you're asking, Ron Wood is asking for almost the same thing that they are doing a like kind into your grant, into the figures. Where's this connection come from?
First of all, I'm a board member. I collaborate with a lot of agencies, okay? As the director of Ron Wood Family Resource Center, I work with Partnership Carson City. I work with all of the nonprofits in town. This is a wonderful opportunity for my foster youth program, which I have 18 programs at Ron Wood, the foster youth program, to defer some of that restricted money that is restricted for youth tryout employment to this new project. Okay, everything that we do has to be grant specific, and it has to, any money that I get from the government, state, local, federal, has to go directly to that program. So it's apples and oranges, really, no pun intended, with the harvest stuff.
All right. Okay, thanks everybody. Thank you.
I get to stay.
Joyce, you're up.
I'm up.
Joyce, you can introduce yourself.
Absolutely. change my hat a little bit here, talk about something that I did write this. So if there's any errors in here, it's all on me, okay? I'll tell you that right away. Joyce Buckingham, Executive Director, Ronwood Family Resource Center.
All right, thank you, Joyce.
Thank you.
With respect to this program, I was looking at, there is some salaries in there, but it's not the Executive Director.
Correct, it's direct services it's only.
Services, okay. Mm-hmm. That was my question. Other questions up here?
Now, there are many grants that I have to throw my time in on, you know, that and the Reach Up program is just one of them, but many of the 18 programs we have, they consider that in-kind match, or they just don't cover indirect. So, unfortunately, that's the way life is, so. Okay.
2015, you were granted $30,000. Is this just a grants program? You have no income?
No, have no income. The only money that we've received from this is due to the need of what we need for our young people. The Reach Up program was patterned after, in 2007, under the Solace Tree in Reno, you know, and that is helping kids through grief, bereavement, loss issues, loss of a loved one, separation anxiety, that type of thing. And what it did actually was morph into what the community needed, which is what Ronwood is all about, not duplicating services, trying to fill in the gaps of what's going on in this community. So what we've done is, through a collaboration of not only the licensed social worker that runs this program, but also licensed clinical social workers, psychologists, all give their time for free to the program. And that is assist young people with issues that they're having, and it could stem from drugs, alcohol, possibly a sexual assault. More recently, we're getting a lot of referrals from Carson City School District that have to do with truancy. Requests for involvement, that there are two big issues right now, and this is kind of the expanded nature of this program, and that is for bullying. And as you all know, there is a legislative mandate that the school district respond to that. So we have been seeing a lot of those young people and helping both in their treatment, if you will, but also so that they can get to the professional if they need to, if there's something more severe going on that's outside of the scope of work of what my licensed social worker can do. The other issue is cutting. We're having a very large influx. We're getting a lot of referrals from the school district. Sorry,
I wish I had
my water bottle here. Anyway, for young people that are cutting themselves. And so thank you, Janice. Excuse me. Talk too much, that's my problem. Anyway, so what we do is we have been running more groups for kids that are cutting and also seeing them individually. And that blends into what the Reach Up program is all about. Now, we thought many years ago that maybe what we could do is we would be able to diminish the amount of money we asked for because the need wouldn't be so great. With Affordable Care Act and so forth, you assume that more young people are on Medicaid, and that they have their needs met. We're not seeing that. If they do come in and they don't meet the low to moderate income criteria, if they have insurance or they have other means or what have you, they are triaged out to the professional that they can either pay for or that they can utilize their services under their insurance that they have. So who we're seeing are very much low to moderate income young people. We're engaging the parents as well because we all know that you've got to have a parent's buy-in before the healing starts. But we do work with the youth, 3 to 17, individual sessions and then group sessions, and then we refer out to other services that are grant-funded in different respects. But the Reach Up program itself, it has not gotten a grant funding source other than through this body, through CSSG.
I read that in your page 8 of your grant, mm-hmm. as to it was going to be covering. But if you checked off severely disabled adults, homeless persons, but it says pages 317.
We have homeless children that are in the Kids in Transition program. you know, through the school district. That means they're classified as homeless, meaning that they're couch surfing, living in a motel, or living out at the river. Okay? As far as disabled adults, we do have parents with some disabilities, and we're working with their children because of a multitude of issues. You know, that is also the case. I would say more than anything else, the abused children fit the category, but I also support the fact that the other categories that I've indicated, we do serve those folks, including 10% of who we serve are Spanish-speaking only, and we do have 6 translators that are available at my service that assist this program, too.
Going back to something that I think you hinted at, the kids that you serve, 3 to 17, experience the loss of a loved one, risk of suicide, suffer extreme dysfunctional family issues, poor educational performance, truancy, chemical dependencies. That's not exclusively the problems set for low to moderate income.
Right.
Have you contemplated a sliding scale or ability to pay type approach to this rather than all three services?
We have not, and that's largely because if they have another means to pay, we will be able to send them out. Yeah, those. And if you noted that on, I want to say my outputs, which was a representation of last year, I think that's on page 6 of the 17. And if you look there and you can see that percentage of participants that are low to moderate income, we had indicated we're looking at 98% or 95%, but actually it was 98%, which at that point we were 103% over goal of what we were planning. So as you can see, what we end up doing is screening out the individuals that can pay. But what I will say is that we do a little triage before we start services, which really represents where they can best be served. And if they do have insurance or do have a means to pay, then we do have those resources that we're glad to offer them.
And the other providers in Carson City are able to accommodate these people?
Yes. Yes, yes. And it by and large, it's not the majority. It is a very small percentile because generally speaking, you know, the Ron Wood Family Resource Center is classified as a low to moderate income neighborhood. And most of who we see do fall in that category. And most of who we get referred by juvenile probation and Carson City School District fit in that category. In the event they don't, then they are... We offer them we give them the outreach of where they could go also that might better suit their needs, or if it's outside of our scope of work.
Page 8 of your application. Number 7, you said that you have plans to charge a fee for service, but I didn't see that in the projected cost, income. Can you tell me what that...
We have not got to that point yet. You know, Ron Wood's philosophy is that we serve all regardless of their ability to pay. So where, in fact, you know, we would like to at some point be able to offer services to all on a sliding fee scale, at this point we're focused on those most in need that are the low to moderate income, and we have been referring the others out. We're hoping in our 5-year plan, our strategic plan, we are hoping to get to that point. But, Carol, at this point, we have not gotten to that point.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions out there for Joyce? Thank you.
All right. Could I just add one more thing? I just wanted to also, and I know I'm over time here, but I wanted you all to know how much both the school district and juvenile probation count on this program. But when kids are suspended, if they come through our program, through the Reach Up services, their expulsion is cut in half because the school district really sees the value of what we're doing. So I wanted to add that in. I apologize for going over. Thank you all.
Thank you, Joyce. All right.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
I'm Wendy Firestone from Big Brothers Big Sisters of Northern Nevada. I'm the Fund Development Director. So if there's any mistakes on the grant, it's also my fault.
As I was reading this, I didn't see any statistics relative specifically to Carson City. How many members are in Carson City? I think maybe it said there was 20 in the program last year, but was that an approximation, your best guess, or was that an actual number?
For last year, whatever the number I gave you would have been the exact number. I think the number that I gave you was for this year that we're looking at. Is that 20?
No, I know. 20 was the number.
Yeah.
But that's.
That's for the children that were served in this area. That's true.
Okay, that's only Carson City.
Yes, just the Carson City matches. We actually served 605 matches altogether last year.
600.
Five altogether,
okay.
But 20
no,
in Carson City.
Mm-hmm. So we're about 1/30th of your program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any information about what the population in Carson City is that is in need of the Big Brother Big Sister program?
I actually tried to look for exact poverty figures for Carson City and was not able to find those. In the Nevada, I think it is like 1/20th of the population. So if you just, you know, look at the number of kids, that would be, yeah, that, I mean, that's, you know, a general statistic for Nevada. So I don't know if Carson City has a greater percent of kids living in poverty or less, but I mean, at this point, that's far greater than the children we were able to serve, so.
Do you know how many people have been served in Carson City over the past 5 years or so?
Oh gosh, I wouldn't know that number off the top of my head, but I could look it up. The program in Carson City used to be bigger. There was a bigger program and funding down here. We had some grant monies that allowed us the opportunity to actually have an office down here. And that grant money went away. And at the time, there was the Mentor Center here. And so we kept our matches going and supporting the matches that we had in this area, but we didn't actively recruit bigs or littles for a couple of years. And then the Mentor Center closed, and it was kind of like, okay, so I guess we need to start focusing our energies back in this area.
Okay. I don't know whether it was just my application or all of them, but there was no 501c3 letter in the application.
Oh, okay. Well, that was my fault, and I can certainly send you that.
I did see a 990, and I assumed that.
Like the IRS determination letter, is that what you're referring to?
The 501c3 letter that says that you are categorized or classified as a.
Okay. Yeah, we can get you that.
But you did have a 990 in there, which I assume is only applicable to a 501c3.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Other questions?
What the national organization does for us is they provide, our advertising budget is zero. So any of the, if you've seen any of the Big Brothers Big Sisters advertising on like ESPN or any of those things, that's actually comes from national. They also support our research and the data collection system that we have. They develop it and sustain it for us. We have a software program that we enter all of our data into that helps us collect data both locally and nationally, and they support all of that. So that's where their funding goes to. We actually don't get any money from Big Brothers Big Sisters. They did write a federal grant, and we, through them, are receiving some federal money. But it's not their money. It's federal money that's coming through OJJDP because we're a recognized prevention program.
So do you acquire funds any way other than grants?
We do fundraisers. We have our donation center, which collects used clothing and household items in the communities where we are, and we sell those to savers for money. That's actually about a third of our budget. We also have private funders that fund us. We do individual giving campaigns, asking people to support our program in the community. So yeah, we pretty much any revenue stream that we can. We actually are coming up with a new fundraiser we're doing this year. It's called Over the Edge, and people can, if you raise $1,000, you can rappel off the Grand Sierra Resort, which is 26 stories. So I mean, we just really are. Any way that we can raise money, we're trying to raise money.
Creative. Sure. Well, I have one other question. You were talking about the computer program, the database, the accounting, and so on. And I'm wondering, do you track either the services provided or the budget expense or the revenue that you receive? Specific to zip codes or communities, or is it all one lump sum as far as
We do break out the Carson City program because we have a couple of grantors. We have the Harley-Davidson Foundation and the John Ben Snow Memorial Trust, who also want to fund just Carson City program. So we break those numbers out.
Okay.
And it's a percent of the total served, you know, so we can look at the total and break out the percents based on how many kids we serve in the area. Because there's recruitment staff and, you know, the program director and those kinds of things work with all the kids, so, and the enrollment staff too. So the match support specialist that we have just works just here in Carson City.
Thank you very much, Wendy.
Sure.
Thank you. All right, now we have time for a break. I think we'll take about 10 minutes here, and we'll come back and talk to the rest of the groups.
Yes, I'm Mary Tumbush. I'm a grant writer for the program.
I'm Florence Phillips, the founder and director of the program.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. So today, the way it's going to work is the same as everybody else so far. We're just going to ask questions, and if we have any, I'm assuming we have any. I think I have some questions, but I'm going to let everybody else jump in first. So any other questions out here for ESL and health?
I do. Very easy question.
Yeah.
If I understand it correctly, the budget provides for 50% of salaries for overhead.
No.
50% of your total.
Okay. Of our total we're asking for, or of the whole program?
No, I'm looking at
this. This is page 8.
Yes. Okay. 10,000 is not 50% of 51,000. So
no, it's a third.
Okay. But that's a fifth.
Of the third, okay, I'm confused about what you're asking. Are you asking for excuse me, total funds for the entire project or for what we've asked for from the Carson City development?
I am just trying to confirm that I understand correctly that all the money requested from this grant will be invested in Carson City only participants.
Correct.
Okay. That's all.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, and then I'll go ahead and kind of go around here since I've got a question. The question on this one, I think, that's come up in the past is the question about duplication services. And I think because we have the time today to talk a little bit about, maybe you guys could comment from your perspective what that really means to you relative to, I believe it's the Hispanic group.
United Latino
community. Yeah, that where questions have come up in the past. Mm-hmm. If we could get some clarification there, because that is kind of, I think,
questioning the difference between the two, or okay?
Yeah, I mean, is there a difference?
Yes, right? Okay. A big difference in my thinking.
Sure.
ULC is using the tutors and students that I had in that building, and they're contacting others, of course, and they contact them and tutor them in the ULC building, which is Partnership Carson City. My program tutors morning, noon, night, weekends, depending on the need of the student. And I have volunteers that match the needs of those students. We go in home, we go into the student's home or the tutor's home if she requests that and the student has transportation. We go into the schools. We have classes in schools. The parents that bring their children will stay for an ESL class. We have various places in Carson, the senior citizen, the community center, the counseling center. We used to have it here in Brick, you know, wherever we can get sites for teaching more than one-on-one. So we have small groups. We don't have classes. We have the dropouts from the classes. So we call ours groups, small groups of 3 to 5 parents in one group. So that's why we have to have various sites in Carson. And Carson has been very open to donating space for us. So that's the difference. We also teach not only ESL, but we teach GED preparation. We've had a few students that have their GED diploma. We teach citizenship study. We have 20 attending in the library, a citizenship class that we have for 12 weeks. We have computer classes because we found out that learning, just knowing English is not enough to get a job. So we have computer classes in English and in Spanish. And we have
financial literacy.
Thank you. Yeah. Financial literacy going along with computer. I have tutors that are willing to do all of these things. Citizenship tutors, GED, ESL on all levels, not just beginners, but those that have learned English at work. And so we break the bad habits that they developed from learning, you know, on the job. Yes.
Do you refer people who do not have transportation issues or hours issues to the United Latino communities?
If they don't have transportation issues?
Right. If they're able to make
if
it.
If they have to make classes.
We go hand in hand.
And ULC refers people with problems,
especially for citizenship. They just did now sent us some students who are interested in the U.S. citizen. We have 199, by the way, citizens. 199 of our students.
Yes, have become citizens.
Yes.
And 20 more.
20 are now, and there'll be more. There were 28 on the list who registered, but, you know, from day to day, week to week, things happen.
And that's the other difference is the expanse of what they these tutors can teach. Workplace communication is another,
yes.
And like she said, the financial literacy, computer literacy, GED preparation. So
and we have English conversation for those that have been our students with our curriculum, but are too shy and timid, afraid to make mistakes. So they're not speaking English except with your tutor. So I've developed English conversation where some of the students come together with a facilitator who helps them with pronunciation and tenses, et cetera. And that's working out beautifully.
As a clarification and as a disclosure, I did volunteer with your group.
Yes, Carol, I know that.
Thank you. And which popped up a question. Instruction material. When I was volunteering, the volunteers was required to purchase the books for themselves and the students, and I don't see that as a line item, that donation charge of the volunteers in your P&L.
Okay, because, may I answer that,
mm-hmm.
Carol? Because it's not mandatory. We gave the tutor a choice.
Okay.
You could have these books, but you cannot write in them or highlight. You'll have to give it back so we could recycle to another tutor. Or if you wish to keep it, because there are some tutors that do want to write in it, then they donate the cost, which is
$25. And is that a line item somewhere?
The on page 8, the instructional materials.
Yes.
At 19,000. Yeah, for what we're asking, the Lomba and the books
student
that you
books.
The student books are $80 for student and tutor. So that would cover approximately 300. At that cost.
For on page 8.
On page 8.
Your P&L. Is there a line item on your income that shows the breakdown of what you receive from volunteers purchasing their own books?
No, we didn't have that.
No, because they don't always do that. Some of our tutors will say, you know, I'll just use the books and return them. Not every tutor pays $25. It's only those that want to write and highlight. Like retired teachers, they're used to, you know, writing in their books. So, yes, they'll donate. I beg your pardon?
How many volunteers do you currently have?
In Carson, of course.
Yes.
Carson, we have 40 tutors tutoring 267 students. And we have almost 400 on a waiting list. So I'm trying to recruit more tutors. I do have some waiting, but the funds to purchase the books is what's holding us up.
And what was your student count?
We have currently 260 students right now, but 398 adults on the waiting list. In Carson City.
And 20 tutors waiting to tutor. But, you know, if I don't get them right away when they're motivated,
yeah.
You know, but what's holding me up is purchasing the books.
Thank you.
Other questions?
No, I wanted to mention part of the schools that we have. Empire is one on the program right now that the parents can just, when they drop their kids off, attend a class. Carson Middle School is on the waiting list, but we don't have the supplies to be able to do that. Seeliger and Mark Twain are also interested. And have they started that program at Seeliger and Mark Twain?
No, because I am waiting for, what happened was we send a flyer home we give them to the school, the ESL children, to take home to the parents. It's both in Spanish and English. And they're to call for those that are interested who could stay at the school when they drop off their parents. So the school is compiling a list of those calls. All the schools are doing that.
That wraps up all of our questions. Thank you
very
much. Great.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. And have a wonderful afternoon.
Okay, next up, we are running just about 10 minutes behind here, but we're sticking to the schedule as best we can. Carson City Public Works.
Oh, sorry.
What did you say? Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Oh, yes, thank you. Patrick Pittenger, Carson City Public Works Transportation Manager. And if you allow me, I would just like to make a few points.
So we're doing things a little bit differently. So we used to do the 5-minute presentation, 5-minute questions. We're just going around with questions. How about I see if there's questions, and we should have a couple minutes.
Okay.
So, but, yeah, questions out here, folks? Go ahead.
Came about the fire department and the parks department did away with not submitting budget figures, nor your department, Public Works. There's nothing in this package that I saw that has anything as far as the budget for Public Works and why this road needs to come to a grants instead of it being budgeted in your normal process.
Oh, be happy to share that. A response to that. Okay, so you have the budget available for you for the project, but you're talking about the budget of the entire Public Works Department?
Yes, for Crescent City.
Oh, okay, well, that's obviously available to anybody in the public at any time. We'd be happy to share it with you, and it's accessible any day of the week for anybody who's ever interested. But I will just tell you in general terms, we receive in the neighborhood, and I'm right in front of me, approximately $8 million a year in gas tax and sales tax can be used for street improvements, maintenance, operation, projects, and the like. We do have costs that we have to undertake every year. For example, keeping the street lights turned on costs money every day. And, you know, every month we have traffic signals maintained, the striping on the streets. We have a lot of sidewalks that, you know, we have to fix even on an emergency basis. Don't have a very big program there. The bottom line is that we have, after we incur those costs for maintaining the streets, we have about $1 million a year to repair roads. And this is certainly one of many, many projects that could be funded with that money. And we do think it is in desperate need of funding, but it is a relatively low volume road, but it is an eligible project in an eligible area. It's in a low to moderate income area. It didn't used to be. We had always considered this to be, in our opinion, a low to moderate income area, but the maps provided by Housing Urban Development did not depict that as such. So we actually had received numerous calls in the past of, why are you spending money on Long Street or by Empire Elementary or various other places, but not here? And we told them flat out, we agree with you, but the maps won't let us do it. Now the maps do let us do it. And that's why we thought this was an appropriate project to bring forth.
Well, I agree. It is a very bad, needed repair.
I'm glad.
But why isn't it on your schedule for repair, since it is probably the worst street in this city that I've had to drive on? Why isn't that make it number one priority to fix your $1 million?
Frankly, because we have tens of millions of dollars of existing paved roads. You know, it's a very large asset that are currently deteriorating very quickly. And much of this road isn't even paved, which is unfortunate, of course. But we don't have enough money to, frankly, maintain the paved roads that we have now. Not even close. We're not even in the ballpark. So it is difficult to prioritize the paving of an unpaved road when you don't even have near enough money to even maintain the paved roads that you have now.
So you'll get us those figures.
You can have whatever you want. Okay. If I would have known, I would have brought you more. Would have been happy to.
Patrick, in the past, you've brought to us a bunch of sidewalk projects. Are you all out of
low to moderate incomes sidewalk?
Absolutely not. I could take $5 million today, but you are absolutely correct. The past projects have primarily been sidewalk projects, and we've done a lot of really good work with that, and there's still a huge need there as well. I think I heard at least one person snicker last year of, hey, you brought the same project you did for the last 5 years. And there is there's a huge need for the sidewalks. There's an even bigger need for the roads. So it's not that we don't have needs. It's just that we thought it appropriate to go to this area. And while there are certainly areas in this section of town that could use sidewalks, it is a really tough road to hoe because when you're repairing an existing sidewalk, like over by Empire Elementary, like we're about to do, it's just repairing existing sidewalk. If you go to build new ones, it's actually much more difficult and expensive. So so no, there's no lack of projects. It's just there are other needs as well.
I'm just trying to, well, I'm searching to see if RTC has a prioritized list for projects that would fit into the LMI category. And it strikes me that this particular project is going to serve a very few number of people. It's basically going to serve the people who front on the road.
So if I could address that, Maurice White, I live on that road. I've lived there since 1958. This road has been in city possession since that time, and it rarely receives any maintenance. While there are only 15 residences on that street, after they put Northridge in, the people come out of Northridge down Carmine, and they cut through Nichols Lane to try to beat the light at the corner of Airport and Highway 50. So currently there is about 160 car count a day on this road. So it serves all of the neighborhood rather than just the people that live there. The city comes and fixes that road about three times a year. In fact, they just fixed it again yesterday. They did it in October, and they had to do it again yesterday. So I think with the $227,000 over the long term, with the drainage and erosion problems that are on that road, you're going to see a pretty good savings because they won't have to come three times a year to fix it.
And if I may, there, while you mentioned the residences at the south end of this property, I've spoken on numerous occasions to other folks, not just who's with me today, but Mike Ball from the Carson Nursing and Rehab. There are two businesses at the south end of that road that have a lot of traffic, and he has been in contact with me several times. They're very concerned about that road. The fact of the matter is that even if we get this project, it would make wonderful improvements to it, make it much better. Even with this project, it's still not going to be the ideal road, and there's no sugarcoating that. It would be a massive improvement. It's still not going to be the best road in town. It was only dedicated as a 21-foot right-of-way. That's all the land we have. That doesn't even meet the standards of an alley in our own Carson City Municipal Code. But while it won't be the best road, it's never going to be the best road in the city. It would be a massive improvement over what they have today. Yes, sir.
Being what you just said,
yes,
it's substandard in width. It's been substandard forever. Mm-hmm. It's now being used, and I understand exactly what you described, or Morris described. Mm-hmm. People cut through there. Why is it not closed through traffic? Like we've done other roads for similar reasons off of Arrowhead, we closed off those streets so they couldn't cut through the 50 down there by Bowers. Why aren't we just closing this street off and then making a better use of it? If we do one day make improvements to it through your program, it would be maintained much easier if only 15 people are accessing it instead of 160 that Morris has run through there every day.
Well, 160 is frankly closer to the residential area. I think it's higher on the south end. Mm-hmm. The road you're referring to on Arrowhead is no longer closed.
Oh, okay.
We reopened it in May of 2012.
Sure.
I made sure I was about
to
go. Just so you know, and we reopened it with zero problems. Okay. Frankly, now having said that. The issue of cut through traffic, unfortunately, is not limited to this road. You know, I've gotten calls for, hey, people are cutting through my neighborhood, from literally every neighborhood in this entire city.
But on the roads in this kind of condition?
This is definitely, yes.
20-foot right-of-way instead of 60, which we prefer.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, and one of the things that you noticed that we did include in here is the, not only is it for paving, but it's also for drainage, but also to explore options for traffic calming measures, you know, to see what we can do to control the speed. But 21 feet is wide enough to build a road that has a lane in each direction, and also to encourage safer practices. We sometimes have people now more towards the south end that are actually parking in places they shouldn't because, frankly, it doesn't even look like a road. And I know that, you know, and we want to be, you know, one of the things that our city manager is a huge advocate of is getting public input and making sure that we, you know, for example, Carol, we don't have enough money to build the roads. This year, the Board of Supervisors, for the first time ever, actually transferred $370,000 from the general fund to streets and told us specifically to be responsive to citizen requests, which is exactly what we're doing with a wide crack repair project. In this case, Morris is here today, but he's not, you know, not to be, you know, offensive. There's nothing special about Morris in this case. Other people complain too, right? He's not the only one. I want to make sure that's clear. Other people, other residents and other businesses complain as well. And because we now have the map that does agree with us that it is a low to moderate income area, we thought this was another opportunity to be responsive specifically to citizen complaints, to our Carson City Connect requests, and to be consistent with the city manager's vision as well.
And I think to address that drainage issue a little bit, this neighborhood never had any draining engineering or any of that. One particular event we had several years ago left a ditch in that road that was 4 feet wide and 3 feet deep. That's not an exaggeration. I put a tape measure in it to see when my truck was stuck in the ditch. So I think we're looking at a situation that could really mitigate some dangerous issues as well, depending on how the water comes from uphill above us.
So that just for everybody else's benefit, I'd like for Patrick to explain the relationship between 160 trips per day and how that number would be generated by a traffic engineer if he was looking at, like, the number of homes on a cul-de-sac, for example. You would predict that there would be so many trips per home. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, it's called trip generation. And I was just looking at a trip generation study for a Nevada Rural Housing Authority project. Yes, the traffic engineers provide reports saying that this type of commercial development, you know, generates this many trips per day and this many peak hour trips per day and the like. And indeed, like I said, the 160 was closer to the residential area and is more than you'd expect of that many homes. So there are some people that are driving through, which is, you know, not surprising. And indeed, I'm sure there are more trips on the very mouth of the road where it hits US 50, because typically I think the people that are going to the car dealership are just coming in and out at that point, not all driving through.
And so the out of the neighborhood people cutting through there is probably, would you make a guess as to what portion of the people are not neighborhood residents?
I wouldn't want to hazard a guess, but I bet you he would, because he witnesses it. I've been there a lot of times, but he's been there more.
Out of 160 people that pass through there per day,
north of 50% is probably a cut through, because it's hard to tell whether they're coming from the convalescent center as employees, which is exactly the difference, but. One of the things that takes place, you can tell the people trying to beat that light at the intersection of Airport and 50, because they're driving about Mach 90 through there. So it's not hard to tell which ones are not street related.
Okay, last question here.
With this funding, mm-hmm. are you able to widen this road, or is it going to remain at 21?
21 is all we own, and we're certainly not proposing in the budget to acquire any land, but we feel confident that with that 21 feet, you can pave 21 feet, have edge lines, you know, just white lines on the edges, and a center line, and actually have two basically full lanes, one in each direction.
No sidewalks as well? Just,
no, just no. But the fact that we would be doing paving, drainage control, and speed control would be an enormous improvement.
Thank you, gentlemen. Next up, we have the Rural Counties RSP program for the rest of the county.
Good afternoon.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm Susan Haas, Executive Director of the Nevada Rural Counties RSVP program, and it's great to be with you here today, and I know that you all have had a long day listening to all of these proposals, and I thank you for your time, and I'm here to request funding for our respite program. If you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer.
I have a question. One of them is, how are your stipends distributed? Is it $2,100 per person lump sum, or is it based on the number of visits, or how far they drive? Or?
The $2,100 is based on $175 per month stipend. We do ask for a commitment from our volunteers, because as you probably know, those that need respite care need this break because it helps actually literally to keep its life-saving. And so an occasional break is great, but the families need regular breaks. So we ask for a commitment of time anywhere from 20 to 40 hours per month. So if a volunteer provides 20 hours or less, they get $87.50. If it's 21 hours or more, they get the $175. Sometimes people will feel more comfortable with committing to only 20 hours, and that way we can bring on more volunteer care to help.
And my other question was, could you explain the costs for training a class of volunteers?
There's not a heck of a lot of cost to it. We've been really fortunate that we have a fantastic partnership with the University of Nevada Reno Cooperative Extension, which is just a couple of doors down. So we are able to utilize that room at no cost. But then there's we do have snacks. We bring in some, you know, a little coffee and bananas, maybe some granola bars. We have the paperwork that's involved with getting the agenda and mailing out the newsletter, announcing it, the postage to mail out to volunteers to let them know about the training. So there's not a heck of a lot. We don't pay for anybody to come speak to us. We get pro bono speakers anywhere from the State Fraud Patrol to Aging and Disability Services, a Sanford Center for Aging, the Alzheimer's Association. Many of our partners, Parkinson's, come in at no charge and provide us with information that will be useful for our volunteers, especially those that are working with those with dementia, compassionate communication, how to get the folks to think about something else. If somebody's, you know, obsessing about, where's my mom? We don't want to say, your mom's been dead for 20 years. We want to say, oh, she'll be back later. So there's, you know, we can tell some therapeutic fibs, and that's okay. And we'll have clients that will fire our volunteers, and they'll say, well, I don't need anybody here watching over me. And so then the volunteer would say, well, okay, well, let's just go to the kitchen. Let's get a glass of water. We'll play some cards. And then it works out. It's a way of communicating with people where they are.
So with the program projections that you have, you want to try and get to, if I understand correctly, about 107 Carson City seniors affected by the program, right?
We would like to help as many as possible. With 7 volunteers, we project that we can help 21 families. Typically, 1 volunteer throughout the course of a year will help 3 families. Sometimes 1 volunteer can help 2 at a time, and then maybe someone will go out of the program. They may move away, or sometimes folks do pass away when we work with the elderly.
Are you part of a national organization, or are you just here in Carson City?
RSVP is a self-sponsored 501c3, but we are part of a larger organization, the Retired Senior Volunteer Program, which comes under the umbrella of the Corporation for National and Community Service. So we are a part of that as well.
So this P&L that shows right now, you've got, it looks like about $86,000. Why come into this grant to just put that money into your bank account and set there, adding to the bank account instead of using your own funds for this program?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. To 80.
In your attachments, your P&L on December 31st, 2015.
That's a negative 87,000.
That's a negative.
Yes.
87, but in 2015, or December 15, that's not a negative, is it? It doesn't indicate a negative. Now, if you take your revenue and subtract out your expenditures.
Excess revenue over expenditures, you're talking about the 66,000?
Yes, ma'am.
That's where we're sitting right now, and that's a snapshot in time. But we are a nonprofit, and believe me, we are running right on the edge of profit.
What is your monthly or 6 month? What is your requirements as far as cash on hand to maintain?
We don't have a minimum requirement of cash on hand. We do have a contingency fund that we have $47,000 contingency funds at the moment.
In addition to this. Okay.
Any questions?
So let me just say one thing. I think you all know that there are 4 kinds of people. Those who have been caregivers, those that will be caregivers, those that are caregivers, and those of us that who someday will need care. So I'm very passionate about this program and working with seniors in Carson City. Carson City is a wonderful place to live, and I think we add to the overall quality of life for our city. And by providing this service, I think we do good justice to our citizenry. So thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Okay, and last but certainly not least, we have some time for the Nevada Rural Housing Authority and the Janelle Drive Supportive Housing Phase 2 Training Center project.
Hello, and thank you for your time. My name is Eddie Holt, Director of Real Estate Operations for the Nevada Rural Housing Authority. Next to me is Linda Barnes, our grant writer, who wrote the proposal. And on the other side is Don Bubble, who is the senior project manager, who will be in charge of the project.
Thank you all for coming. And just when you're signing, you just try and write in print your name to the list so that we can tell you later. Thank you. All right. Well, so this is a new one for all of us, I believe, and we will almost certainly have some questions. I know that I do. Let's see here.
I'll start out with
one. Go ahead, Fred. Yeah, thank you.
You're building 39 units.
Yes, 39 units of permanent supportive housing for homeless, and we also have 8 veteran vouchers, VASH vouchers. So some 8 of them could be up to veteran or more.
So that would come out of the 39? So it'd be 31 plus 8?
Yes.
Okay.
If we fill the vouchers, yes.
How rapidly are these expected to fill?
The general market study, because there's vouchers associated with all 39 units, probably less than 6 months.
I guess one of the questions that I have is, if you didn't get the training center, could you use unoccupied apartments in the interim for like a year or something?
Well, these apartments are very small. When you build transitional permanent housing like this, they're built at about 530 square feet each. They're enough, and speak to say, you get them in there, they live, and they it's not the Taj Mahal, so you're trying to transition them out through not only the on-the-job training center. Again, we're, as you've probably read, we're supporting this with FISH. It's their on-the-job training center, and we're trying to support as a developer. And their job is to try to get them in, and there'll be those people that will stay there for 12 to 18 months. There'll be those people that transition to 2 or 3 months. So, but we have to call it permanent supportive housing because we're taking federal monies from it as a tax credit. That's the major money that's building the actual apartment complex.
So what is your turnover rate? How long do you expect them to be in this?
Well, the people from FISH, and we're working with Carson City Social Services and FISH, and they believe, they told us with the market study that they felt that the turnover would be about 39 units, probably about 50 to 60 people a year. I said there'll be some that will stay for 12 to 18 months. There'll be some that stay for 2 or 3 months.
But am I correct in learning this grant that this is for the training center,
yes,
not the housing?
Yes. Yes.
You're very vague about the training. Training to do what?
Well, right now, FISH has 4 things that they do. They repair furniture. They repair appliances. They repair other wooden items, frames of pictures and things like that, and they also have a machine that they have that does compaction. So they do compaction of materials for dumps and things like that. So they're basically trying to teach those 4 things that they want to offer. And Jim from FISH is not here, Jim Peckham. I apologize for that, but we're going to offer 3 other programs. They're just writing in right now, but they haven't started them because their current FISH building does not have the room for it. So they're going to have basically, the program is supposed to have 7 types of operations that they would do. Anything from, again, furniture repair, appliance repair. I believe one of them is going to be some kind of a small tool repair, like motorcycles to lawnmowers to chainsaws and those type of things, small tool repair. Other than that, I don't know. I can't answer for Jim there.
So can I ask a question? First of all, I applaud you on the project. I was there at the board when it was approved, and some of you that haven't signed. I think it's going to be a great thing for the community, especially in that neighborhood. It's going to be wonderful inclusion. And I have a question on the training. So someone's there for only a couple months as opposed to 18, and they're starting the training. Would they still avail themselves of that training even if they move somewhere else to live? Or is it only for people that are living there?
I believe what Jim had told me, most of the training would be about 30 to 45 days, and then they have a step-up training. Okay, the first training is basic training, and then they have like an intermediate training. And once they get through that intermediate training, they feel that's about the time that people will transition out, because then they've got enough training to be able to go to a market to either be an apprentice or...
do on-the-job training.
Yeah, do real on-the-job training somewhere at a thing. And they're trying to use that basis of that intermediate training. The basis training at least give them some tools. The intermediate training to give them some tools so at least they can walk into a job and say, hey, I may not have a GED or I may not have this or that, but I can maybe get that job. So that's what they're trying to do. Right now at the FISH place they have now up on Long, and they just have enough room to basically give that beginning training. They can't go all out.
So my question was going to be actually a little bit about the details here. So the rooms and the shell portion of that, could you kind of give us a framework of what that really means?
John, would you go ahead?
I'm inside the shell. There's going to be a janitor room, and there'd also be a bathroom, a unisex bathroom. Also, there would be a classroom where they would teach life skills to the people that are living there also. so they could transition back onto the street. So there will be that type of setting also.
So,
and then there'll be machinery set up inside there. We've noticed they want to put a planer, chop saw, things like that to rebuild furniture. Like Eddie talked about, the baling machine, like you compact cardboard, things like that. They have a machine that does that. It teaches the individuals how to use those also.
So, but just to be clear, the rooms in the shell just basically gets the structure and the kind of finished work interior done, but not like a lot of the details for facilitating these other items, correct?
What we've asked in this grant is to pay for the shell and the support of utilities and your basic gas, water, power, get it to the shell. Fish has a $65,000 commitment to us as a developer to pay for the inside T&Is and to finish the classroom and get their own equipment set up.
Would you clarify that on page 6 of the grant, item number 8, that if you're only partially funded, you could cut this down to $194,842, which is roughly $30,000. What would you be eliminating for that $30,000 difference?
She's pulling up reference right now. Okay, what we were going to do is the where is the developer, because of the building, the apartment building, are putting the foundation and the base laid on, and that's approximately about $18,000. The bid of the shell is $176,000. So that's the 194 and 190, whatever, 194 that we're talking about here. We could get to that level. If we can't, and then on the backside is the $65,000 that the fish will put in to the project. We're still about $20,000-$25,000 difference, but we will put the bill, NRHA will probably write the check for that. So what we're trying to say is that what we have to have is the first $60,000 commitment from NRHI, who's putting the foundation framework in, and then what we're asking from you guys, $225,000 will help us build it the right way, but if we only get a certain amount, at least $178,000, what we're looking for at the least, that will get us at least the shell built and get it to a point where we can get, from according to the building inspector, we can get, what's it called,
temporary CFO.
We can't use the building. We still have to put all the TIs and do certain things on it, but we at least get a temporary CO so we can get the apartments done, and then we'll have to look for other funding in the future if we can't get it.
I'm getting more confused rather than less confused.
Okay.
The primary sponsor for this is Fish, and the trainees who are graduating from this program are primarily going to Fish?
Well, between Carson City Social Services and Fish, these are people that those two programs have basically put into the apartments. Okay? And then once they get to the apartments, there's three bases. There's a property manager, just a general property manager. There's a secondary specialized property manager that will be there, that's being hired to basically take care of this type of living situation. They're different than running a regular apartment. Running a homeless shelter, running that type of thing is a little bit different. That we actually had our first advisory meeting yesterday. It's a group of people from Continuum of Care, Carson City, Fish, NRHA, and two or three other factions are putting a board together. They're the advisory board to that. Then there's a third faction that Fish comes in and evaluates those people for the on-the-job training and life skills. So between those three, the property manager, the specialty property manager, and Fish, those last two will be the ones that will evaluate for the on-the-job training and life skills and what they need to do to help transition them through the program. Does that help?
I'm wondering where these people are going to go after they've received 35 days or whatever the 30 to 45 days of training.
Well,
and you've indicated
the fish
40
is
to 60 per year, and I can't imagine Fish turning over, vacating 40 to 60 positions to accept all these trash compactors and plants repairmen and furniture repair people. And so I'm wondering, what is this training going? You know,
maybe if Chris can accommodate, maybe they have a turnover of three people a month. I have no idea. But three people a month is not going to accommodate all the people that you're proposing to graduate from this training center.
No, and how I understand it, and again, I'm not here to speak for Fish, and I apologize for that, but basically, Fish will evaluate. Not everyone that walks in the door and gets an apartment is going to be on the job training center that day. I mean, there's going to be some people that need life skills and just some things just to get them there. That'll all be evaluated. Once those people get in the on-the-job training center, they feel at that point, when they're evaluated to that point, through those two programs, that by that time, they hopefully have people in other circles, capital circles, other circles out there that might want to look to hire these people, whether it's an apprenticeship or at a baseline job. That's what we're all hoping to be. We know with everything going on in the economy and the Tesla effect coming in, we think that there's a need for that in about a year, year and a half from now when this program gets started.
Other questions on that? Dr. Refrain?
Yeah.
We're good? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, everyone.
So now I'd like to open it up for public comment if there is any out there.
So I haven't received any budget information from fire. Patrick, and I sent an email to Pat. Patrick referred me to their presentation that they have